Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of the Virtual Coffee Podcast. I'm Becca, and this is a podcast that features members of the Virtual Coffee community. Virtual Coffee is an intimate group of developers at all stages of their coding journey, and they're here on this podcast sharing their stories and what they've learned. And we're here to share it with you. Here with me today is my co-host, Dan.
Thanks, Becca. Joining us today is Glenn McCallum, a software engineer from Victoria, Canada. Glenn does back-end development in C# and SQL while managing a team of 8 engineers for the second largest independent book distributor in the United States. I really enjoyed our conversation with Glenn. We talked about his career journey, some hard decisions he's had to make along the way, and the unexpected ways that tech has entered his life.
We start every episode of the podcast like we start every virtual coffee. We introduce ourselves with our name, where we're from, what we do, and a random check-in question. Today's question is, you have your own late night talk show. Who do you invite as your first guest? We hope you enjoy this episode. Hey, I'm Becca. I'm from a small town in Ohio. I'm a front-end developer. And if I had my own late-night talk show, I think my first guest would be Mindy Kaling because she does lots of different stuff. She's super smart and funny, and I think she would be fantastic to talk to.
Yeah, she's really cool. This is really hard because there's just so many, you know, like potentials. Hi, I'm Dan. I'm from Lakewood, Ohio. I do front-end development. And if I had a late-night talk show, my first guess, I'm just going to go with recency bias. We've been watching a lot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and Terry Crews is just like one of my favorite people. And he seems very, very cool and interesting, like in the real world too. So that's who I would have as my guest.
Hi, I'm Glenn McCallum. I live in Victoria, Canada. I'm still learning software development, but I have my own team. I manage a team of software developers. If I had my own talk show, my knee-jerk answer to this one was Mr. Rogers.
Because
I have such a special place in my heart for him. But at the same time, I didn't want to have like the awkwardness of a stranger. If I really got to meet someone,
Mr.
I wanted
Rogers
someone...
Rogers isn't a stranger, though.
So the name I'm going to put out there is a name you've never heard of, and it's Robert C. Gay. And it's someone I met by chance. He does private equity investment and dropped it all to do service and charity work in Western Africa. And I had this chance meeting with him and heard him speak, and it was absolutely riveting. So I'd want to talk to him for another full hour if I could.
That's awesome. Yeah, I started going down the road of like, actually interesting people, but that might not make a good TV commercial, you know? And then like, I don't know, I got very confused. So I just like kept it to celebrities, but this is another thing. A whole hour long episode just about some of these questions.
That would be fun. Glenn, thanks so much for being here. We are very, very happy to have you today on the podcast. So thanks for agreeing. We always like to get started with the origin story, where you came from and how you got to where you are. So just the short version of how did you get into tech?
Well, originally, and this goes way back, I wanted to be a large animal veterinarian. And I went through pre-veterinary in school, and I didn't get into veterinary school. And there's only one veterinary school in Western Canada. And they get like 200 applicants and accept 20 positions. And so I was ranked low 30s, as I remember. So it wasn't too discouraging from that standpoint. But, you know, when you're at that age, you just feel like you need to keep moving on with life. And so I had taken a computer science elective course. I'd taken two of them. And just because I thought you can't go wrong with some computer science. And I I didn't take like the computer science for non-computer science people. I wanted to take real computer science. So I took the year one programming courses, and I got A pluses in both of them. And the school sent me a letter asking me if I wanted to join the computer science program. And it all kind of happened at the same time that I got this rejection letter from veterinary college and got this invitation letter to study computer science. And I was like, all right, let's do this. And so that was a transition moment. And that's kind of what got me started on this pathway.
That is awesome. And well, you've been coming to Virtual Coffee for a while too. Do you remember how you found out about Virtual Coffee?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I have to credit it back to Jesse, because I heard Jesse on a podcast months before pandemic, and this interesting thing came out. It's called Moms Who Code, which just sounded fascinating to me, because I mean that notion where your family still comes before code, but you still have that that career integrated. Just, I mean, secretly, I want to be a mom who codes, really. And so I started following some Moms Who Code stuff on Twitter. And from that came this Virtual Coffee. And when it first came up, I thought it was for Moms Who Code. And I initially thought, you know, that would be really cool to meet some people, but I didn't come because I thought it was for the moms. And later on, I started seeing, retweets or lights just popping up in my stream from guys who were going to Virtual Coffee. And that's when I decided to join for the first time in August.
I had no idea. That's the first time I've ever heard that story. So Jesse is my husband, who's also a developer. And Moms Who Code, I was really involved in that early on while I was learning and getting into tech. That's just very, very fascinating. There are lots of moms that do come, and it's nice. A lot of them bring their kids. And so we get to see kids and cats and all the fun people that come to Virtual Coffee. So very glad that you're here and you can hang out with the moms.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I'd been looking for better friends. Is that a way to say it? I love this phrase. It's been attributed to different people. You are the average of your five closest friends. And so, you know, I'd been looking for some better five closest friends to hang out with and just not quite sure how to find them. And so after I came to Virtual Coffee. It was good. And I remember sitting here afterwards, that initial session, and I just felt sort of empty inside. And it wasn't that I realized what I was missing until after I kind of experienced it in that professional connection, that professional camaraderie with excellent people. And I've been coming regularly ever since.
That is really awesome. And I think that resonates with so many people. And I think, you know, having community has been super important in the last year, but also this community has been one of my favorite places ever for people, because I have a hard time making friends or talking to people because I can be really shy. And just having a group of people that I have felt comfortable around has been such a great part of not just the last year, but my adult life.
Well, I think there's something very atypical about this technical group. And I'm sure it's come out and everybody says it. It's just there's no ego. Mm. And nobody's judging or nobody's trying to prove themselves. And so often, I don't care what community, like Stack Exchange, it just seems like the insecurity comes out and that's manifested in snarkiness and and put downs and things like that. But this is just really safe and supportive and welcoming.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. Yeah, I'm not sure what your work situation was before pandemic, but I've been like pretty much remote for my whole career, and I come and go from, searching for communities. You know, I was part of like a meetup group early on, that like a physical meetup group. And then we moved and it sort of fell apart. And then, it's just so hard to find people to like be with, like when we don't have like, you're not going to an office with people, full people and, stuff like that. That's kind of how I've felt too. Like it's just been so nice to like this group, this group doesn't have some of those problems, And so it's my kind of group too, where I can just be comfortable and like, be myself, and not have to worry about the upvotes or the popularity contests or whatever that you run into lots of other places.
And I think the face-to-face interaction, augmenting the online discussion group interaction, it just changes the whole dynamic. Because you really do get to know these people.
Yeah, there's something like really that invites vulnerability and intimacy when you do have that experience. Like you're seeing them, you're hearing their voices once or twice a week. And I loved how you said it in one of the breakout rooms on a Thursday session where you were talking about like, this is like us sitting around a coffee table as friends, just talking. And that's just what it feels like when you're in the room with the people. Okay. So your career, obviously it's been quite a journey. So not only were you going to be a vet, but you made a lot of like big career transitions. And I want to know, there had to be some challenges along the way that I want to hear you kind of talk about. And I'd love to know how you felt as you were going through the challenge. And then now looking back at that challenge in retrospect, like how that's changed, because like so much of the time when you're in the middle of that thing, it feels unbearable. And then once you get out of it, you can kind of look at it a little bit more objectively. So do you have any big moments you could talk about?
We could talk about lots of moments. I kind of spent my first 7 years in enterprise healthcare IT. And there are some big transitions in that. My second 7 years were spent in more tech software development, straight up. And there was a big transition to shift between those. But let's go back kind of while I'm still in enterprise healthcare IT and I'm at Oracle. Because that was things went pretty smooth up until then. I mean, you graduate computer science. I was in the co-op program, so I already had work experience. I had a job offer before I finished school, and things just kind of start trucking along when you're on that kind of traditional track, which is nice. However, and I went to a big integrated healthcare network and did some big type of government work, which is really boring, but we'll continue on. And I got recruited to Oracle to work on their enterprise healthcare analytics platform, and got into that world of traveling. We had a dev team in India in addition to California. So there was like people working on these products 24 hours a day. I would essentially get up, have meetings to transition work back to me. I do my work all day while my counterpart slept. And then at the end of the day, I would hand my work off to him and he would do it. Lots of travel to meet with customers. But, over time, it really took a toll on the family. And I can remember, coming home to the airport, my wife picking me up and just breaking down and crying on the way home, really hard on the family. I can remember my second child would hug the computer and be like, "Good night, daddy," because I would talk to them on Skype And as well as I wasn't liking the person I was becoming, in terms of kind of that environment of traveling, eating nice restaurants, you start to, at least I started to get a certain expectation of how things should be. And when they weren't that way, I just wasn't very nice. I was at Oracle for a couple of years. It was actually the day my third child was born that I decided I was leaving. And not sure what to call it, law or program in Canada, where you can go on employment benefits at the birth of a child, regardless of paternity, maternity. And so I registered for that program, and it gave me a year of minimal income. Mm-hmm. and left Oracle. And that was a major shift for me, because I really didn't know where I was going at that point. Towards the end of that year off, and I did various things on that year off that we could talk about if you want. I finished building our house. I landscaped our yard.
I was just going to ask if you took the whole year. That's awesome.
It gets really boring if you're just sitting around. Although, yeah, there were some complications from that birth, so I was really glad that I was there and available. Towards the end of that year, I tried to get into some consulting work, but I found that my contacts and experience took me into a enterprise type consulting world, which number one was leading back to travel. Number two, it's really hard to financially weather the cycles of enterprise consulting payment. And maybe you've tried that, maybe you haven't. It takes, from the time you have an agreement, it takes a month to get legal review on the contract. After the contract gets legal review, it takes a month to get a billing number set up. And so that's like 2 months from actually getting a deal hammered out before you can start billing. And then there's, you know, submitting the invoice and just kind of waiting indefinitely for payment to come. So it was, and having been at the kind of the tail end of a year of time off, it wasn't very comfortable to financially weather that. So I ran back to the hospital where I worked before and got a position there, which is very senior, but it was an interesting time there. Times had changed there as well. And I was back there for another year, and they were in the process of negotiating a big vendor agreement, $150 million contract for consulting and software services to roll out across the whole health network. And when that got signed, I just didn't feel there was a place for me there, because those types of services that I could offer would be just come through that consulting agreement. And I was just feeling bored. Yeah. And so I had a friend at a sort of an established startup in Victoria, and I had seen postings for that company come up regularly when I was cruising around, and I just asked him if he was happy there. And he said, yeah, they treat me pretty well. And so he put me in contact with his boss, who I also loosely knew. We had lunch and it was a done deal. And that's what got me kind of back onto the software development track from the enterprise healthcare IT track.
That's wild. And I think, I mean, you talk about this all so calmly, but those all seem like really huge decisions to make. Were you ever freaked out about those decisions? You had a kid and your third kid, I think you said, and then you were like, well, I'm not going to do this anymore, right? I don't think I could handle the birth of a child and leaving a job at the same time.
Yeah, now that you point it out. You know, I always had something that that was there for me. I didn't drop and leave into nothing. So, you know, I had a runway and I had a set of contacts when I left Oracle. And I didn't leave the hospital the second time until I had another job in place.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I was just taking a leap of faith here.
I know. I totally get that. It's just transitions, I think, can be so difficult. And so for me, it would require a long stretch of second guessing myself as to whether or not that was a good decision.
And it wasn't without emotion, I'll say that, especially the transition back into software development. Because I joined a team cross international, cross border. So we had split between Canada and Russia on this team, and it was a bit of a rough onboarding in terms of they're putting me through my paces, and it had been a long time since I've been building software. And so I totally get kind of that new developer experience of getting put on a team. And I don't know if hazed is the right word, but maybe a bit where you're getting picked on and you're expected to know things that you really shouldn't be expected to know. And getting hassled a bit when you stumble. And I remember breaking the build and just being really upset, like more upset than I should have been. Looking back, it wasn't a big deal, but to me at the time, I think I like cried in my garage office at the time.
I mean, that kind of thing can feel so stressful, like in the moment, you know, it's, I think that's pretty natural react. I mean, that is a pretty natural reaction to something like that, especially when you're new, right, at a company. Also, especially when it's your first time. If you're an old hat at breaking the production build, like I am, and eventually you realize, like you said, with experience, you realize maybe, you know, it doesn't have to be as big of a deal. But yeah, like that, I don't know. That seems, it's so hard to like think like that when you're in the moment and sweating and like, you know, the thing's broken and I don't know.
Well, and maybe it really wasn't even about that. Maybe it was just about the fact that I'd been through a wide career swing and stuff going on at home and all the implications of that and just all kind of coming out in that one moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like to do that too.
I was just going to say, that's a really good point. I was talking with my therapist about this, about how like on some days, like if the exact event happened on, you know, one day and then happened like 4 days later, my reaction to it, the way I like react to it and the way that like everything else like comes from that will be completely different. Can be completely different if I'm, you know, in that, if I'm like overwhelmed, if they're, you know, depending on like what other external things or internal things are happening, you know, at the moment. I don't know. You know, I don't know. We're talking about how to like, ways to like remember that when you're in the moment, you know, which is like, that's harder. I mean, I don't even have it, the advice, you know, we're just kind of talking about it, but yeah, that like anytime you're in a big transition, you know, of any kind, you know, everything is going to, it's just like a stress on your system, right?
Yeah. But I mean, just like to point out that if it happened to me, it could happen to anybody. I mean, it wasn't like I was new to this game. and going through that and having that experience, just imagine what it's like if you really are new to this game and you kind of don't know the behind the scenes of how things work.
Right. Absolutely. Like you probably knew that, I don't know. I mean, I don't know specifically what was happening with the, with breaking the bill, but like you, you probably knew, you know, intellectually that you didn't like destroy the company or something. Right. You know, but like, yeah, if you're newer to the whole thing, obviously the problems seem bigger, you know?
Yeah.
I know. I've heard of companies when they're onboarding new developers, and I don't know if this goes across the board, whether it's somebody new to the team or just people who are early in their career, but they'll introduce them to other members of the team and ask the other members of the team to talk about what they've broken in the last week or something like that, or their biggest story about that. And I always thought that was a fun way to kind of maybe diffuse that future situation, or to say like, hey, like this is normal, we do it and then we work through it, right? And look, we are a team and we get along.
It's a really good idea. You kind of have to have the right team to feel comfortable sharing that. You know, there's a certain amount of egolessness to get people to open up that way. I think we could do that now. I'm not sure if we could have done that at the time.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's a cool idea, and it's important. I feel like that the people are sharing their own, you know, moments of that, and it's not like somebody saying, "Oh, this guy messed up here and this guy messed up here." So you know, like pointing it out for somebody else, right?
That would be really bad.
That doesn't seem as good, right? that's one of the things I've actually liked about in Virtual Coffee is having, you know, some of the more senior developers like share stories like that a lot. I know Brian he's the first one I think of with this practice, you know, of just like, I don't know, like he also, I mean, he's the, you know, he's like running the company and like, he also has broken the builds at his company, you know, it's just like everybody will be okay, you know? So that, like relating that kind of thing, I feel like is, I don't know, it seems like a good practice, you know?
I also want to touch on a story that you have mentioned, if you're up for it, your first full-time job out of school, the one where you almost died.
Well, before we go there, do you want to finish the topic on change? Because
yes.
Up until now, we've kind of talked about change that I've inflicted on myself. But there was there's been this event in the last 4 years where change was kind of inflicted on me. And that was when the company that I went to after leaving the hospital carved off kind of half of their products and sold them to a book distributor. And with that sale of those products, they took 3 Canadian developers, and I was one of them. And that whole thing was a really interesting day. And it was September 1st, 2016, as I recall. And for weeks, there'd been kind of a oddly placed random status meeting on our calendar for that day. And I didn't think much of it. And I mean, the company I was at had a new CEO and he had a new mandate. At the time, I didn't really know what that mandate was, but he'd been up to visit and to meet us. He lived in Los Angeles and had come up to Victoria. And he'd been hired by the venture capital firm that owned a share of the company. And at the time, I didn't know, but I believe he'd been hired to liquidate the assets of the company. And so this day was the first sale that new CEO had made. And so we walk in, we join this call, and there was a few people on there that I wasn't expecting in terms of higher ups, And then it was like, we'd like you to meet the new owners of this product line. And it was like jumped into 2 hours of PowerPoint and them talking and telling us about their new company.
Wow.
And then it was like,
and that's the first you heard of it at all? Like the first,
it was the first mention I've heard of it. Maybe people knew, maybe I was just isolated. And then they're like, they were in San Francisco at the main company office. And then they're like, we're all going to lunch. You guys go have some lunch. And,
oh, no.
And at the time, I don't remember if they were specific about who they were keeping. And like, we, of course, got off that call and all of a sudden got back on another call, like the secret call, where we kind of like are venting and debriefing about this whole thing. And later that day, I got a letter of offer for a job from them. But I mean, it didn't, just the way, I mean, they're good people trying their best. But the letters of offer weren't quite squared away in terms of what our current positions were and what our benefits were and things, which is fine. They made good on it. They matched everything. So stand-up job for them. Over the next couple of days, they did that. But I, like, not going was not an option for me. I went to my boss, the same one who hired me 2 years earlier, and I was like, so what are my options here? And he is like, if you don't go, we're laying you off.
Yeah. Wow.
But you know how these things are, right? Because at the same time, they had job postings. Hmm. So they didn't need people. They were hiring at the same time, but also learned things in hindsight. The team that they took was part of the sale. They didn't want just the product. They actually wanted to acquire a software development team.
Yeah.
And so that boss, in good faith on that deal, could not have kept me because it was part of their deal they had made between companies.
Right.
Onboarding us, I would say, I mean, technically it was hard because we had shared repos, shared libraries, shared infrastructure, shared continuous integration with the whole other product line. So it took us months to kind of tease all these products apart and get kind of our side of the fence located to a new data center. And even then, I mean, the initial hardware that was spec'd wasn't quite adequate. And so it wasn't quite running right until we got some new hardware in place. I learned, this is a software developer having to take over some infrastructure planning roles, because we had a whole infrastructure team at the old company. At the new company, we didn't. And they're like, Glenn, you're in charge of this. I'm like, okay, we'll do it. But yeah, I think it was harder on their IT team because they wanted software developers, but they had kind of a smaller IT group. And then they brought us in and we're a bit more rough and tumble in how we work together. And we may have overran them a little bit with just our way of doing things, which was good because it's all following software engineering best practices. But I mean, back to my onboarding experience a bit, just a little rougher with each other than some other teams can be. It's not like virtual coffee.
Man, that's pretty crazy. Trying to integrate like a new team into an existing team, you know.
And like, surprise, and you're also, on our team now. Right.
Yeah, the idea of, being an asset in an acquisition, basically, without your, knowledge.
It's an interesting experience.
Yeah.
I'm stressed out hearing it.
All good people, all in good faith. And by no means was it anything shady going on there. Nobody was trying to hurt anyone else, but just difficult change thrown upon you.
When at that time, like when that transition happened, were you still more of like an individual contributor, like in that role?
Yes, I was.
So it was after that. Cause I know now you're managing a team. So did that kind of happen like organically over the preceding, I forget where we are in the timeline, but like in the years after that?
Yeah. I mean, about a year after, there was a software development manager who came over as well with that. And about a year after we got the infrastructure migration complete, they announced they were leaving. And I was offered the position at that time, I think mostly because of my roles I'd had kind of back in healthcare IT.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, that's a choice too. I mean, did you have to think about it? When they offered it, I assume that.
Well, yes, I did.
I mean, like, right. Traditionally that sort of offer will, be like a raise and everything, a new title or whatever, but like it's a different ball game, right? Moving to like,
talk on this.
Well, I mean, for the listeners that don't know, like Glenn did a lightning talk on this transition, for our lightning talk round in February. And it was very, very good talk. And the talk is on YouTube, so we'll link to it. But one of the reasons I was very excited about having you here was to like sort of have you dig in a little bit more, because it's such like a, I don't know. I mean, we've been just talking about transitions this whole time. So I don't want to say like, oh, it's a huge transition compared to a lot of the stuff you've gone through or anybody's gone through, but like it still is as a career choice,
I think it's another different transition, sort of transition, because I went from kind of a team member to team owner.
Respects. Sorry, I just want to pause for a second and see if you can you define the difference between IC to engineering manager.
Define the difference between that. I mean, it's in terms of the work I do day to day, or in terms of how it felt.
Well, you can go with both. I just want to make sure that listeners understand what the transition, what that means in terms of your role and expectations, and I guess how you feel plays into that for sure.
A lot of that can depend on where you are. Where I am, that took me into a kind of a whole new leadership layer that I didn't have any access to before. And I should qualify that I work for what you'd classify as small company, but in my mind doesn't really seem very small. There's 200 staff. There's one large team of software developers and a few IT personnel. But in terms of leadership hierarchy above me, I mean, now I report directly to the CEO and I'm the software development manager. So I'm pulled into many strategic planning, kind of company crisis meeting, things that I just had no knowledge of before. And I mean, that's kind of the tightness of my team going through that acquisition. And having been together through that, I mean, we didn't keep secrets. That was our policy. No secrets. No matter who it hurt among us. I mean, we're trying to hurt anyone else. The policy was you had to tell it. And so me going from independent contributor to the manager is really me kind of leaving some of the closeness and the tightness that I'd felt with those comrades and kind of going out and doing more on my own, which has led to a lot of growth, but also some growing pains there. My work, I do a lot more project planning now, supervising what other people are doing. Occasionally I get to help people and touch code, and that's really fun. I'm probably guilty of touching code too much and avoiding some of my other duties, but that's just me. Do you want me to hit on some other things I talked about in my presentation?
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember what podcast it was. I was listening to another podcast about this and about the, how traditionally the way to move up in a company or, you know, get a raise or whatever is, you know, there's just like a ceiling for being a normal, like a individual developer. And the next step is always management, you know, but the podcast I was listening to was about how, pushing back on the idea. And how about not everybody like is, you know, possibly good at being a manager or wants to be a manager, you know, and things like that. And so anybody that has like consciously made this transition, and you know, I always want to like the things I want to know is like, did you think about that at the time? And now that you're in it, you know, it's from what I can tell, it seems like you're pretty comfortable in the position. But like, are you like glad you ever think about moving back to being, you know, and like it? And I see like in another, you know, if you could keep all of the whatever your current benefits and everything, but be coding all day instead of managing, would you take that job or, you know, would you think about it? You know, that kind of, I know that was just like 7,000 questions that you can pick which one yeah. you want to answer, but
I'm going to start at the beginning. Yeah, there definitely was a ceiling. I think at any small company, there's going to be a ceiling in how far you can progress as an independent contributor. Oracle is different. Oracle had career tracks for software development. And you could have, I mean, you could go all the way up through the levels, almost to the top as an independent contributor. I mean, there were ceilings that you're not going to go to the executive layer moving from independent contributor. You had to go through the management track to get kind of up past that. But you can go a long way as an independent contributor to Oracle and get very good income. But at this small company, I mean, there really wasn't any place for me to go. In fact, I'd say about 6 months before that, I was looking for another job just because I didn't think anybody was ever leaving that was ahead of me, and I wasn't going to have any place to go. And I was looking for some place with more of a progression possible. Mm-hmm. But I had a really unexpected healthcare issue that year. Health issue and a diagnosis. And so over those months, it was just not even on my radar. I was just trying to make some life adjustments. And so when that came up, it was completely unexpected. And, you know, I did think a lot about it quickly. in that, you know, I wasn't in a place to make a transition that year just because of that stuff I was going through in the other part of my life. And so I kind of looked at it like I kind of took over the team when that other person left. Right. And what were my options? I say no, and I'm still running the team while they hire someone. Yeah. And then I'm going to be training the person probably and doing part of their workload for, I'd say, a period of months. And maybe I don't even ever stop doing part of their workload. We'll see. Right. We'll see what they're like. Maybe they don't work out, you know, there's just, and I just stay at my current rate. or if I take it, at least I get a new job title and a pay raise and do what I would have had to do anyway.
Yeah, totally.
So that was the decision that kind of led me through there. Sorry, I lost the second part of your question.
Well, I mean, if you don't remember, I certainly don't remember.
If I could do it over again?
Not if you could do it over again, but if you had the opportunity to
go back
coding all of the time with the same benefits that you have in your role.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So not like, would you go back and make a different choice? But like right now, you know, how much do you miss coding is, I guess, what it, like the... Right. I mean, like, you don't have to answer it like that specifically.
Do I think about it? Only every day. But, I mean, I equate that to taking a step back in the progression of your life to a certain extent. Would it be awesome to go back and live with my parents? My mom makes me French toast every morning. Yeah, that would be really cool. But would you really want to do that? No, I don't think that I could go back and kind of back to that same role where I was before. I think there might be something different for me in the future where I get to do more coding, but we'll just see kind of where that leads.
Okay, so I think there are two ways that this can go. So I still want to hear your story about your first job.
This the story where I almost drowned?
Yeah.
See, I didn't even put that in my speaker notes there.
Well,
but you remembered because I told you at some point.
Yeah, you put it in Slack and I still have a record of that.
So my very first job out of university was setting up health IT systems in remote Aboriginal communities along the western coast of Canada. And so many of these communities or villages are fly-in only or boat-in. I guess traditionally boat-in. And so to go do this work, and we'd be getting, you know, satellite internet hookups, pinging some advanced wireless signals off different islands from the mainland kind of thing, we'd get to charter float planes. And so, I mean, to this day, if I get on a float plane, I fall asleep because I had to leave my house. I'd drive for 2-3 hours. It'd be like 3:30 a.m. I'd get to the float plane dock at 6:30 a.m. We'd get on a float plane. We'd fly for 2 hours and get to our destination. But as soon as I hit the float plane every morning, I was just out. But the company put us through this, it's called egress training. And what it is, I mean, statistically, any plane crashes, like, I don't know what the percentage is, super high percentage to happen on landing or takeoff. And the kind of the creator of this course survived a plane crash himself on the Fraser River in Vancouver. And after that, the RCMP started calling him in to help investigate other plane crashes, especially on water. And what they found was that everybody was surviving these crashes and getting trapped in the plane and drowning. And float planes float. So these people were drowning like only a few feet below the surface of the water because they couldn't get out of the plane.
Yeah, because it's upside down, right?
Or the pontoons are... The plane inverts.
Yeah, yeah.
The pontoons hold the plane up. And so he created this course to teach people how to exit inverted, submerged planes. And so I was put through this course, and the way he did it is he had a 4-foot-deep hotel swimming pool, and he had built this fuselage with seats in it and doors and windows, and they strap you in the seat, and essentially like dump you into the pool upside down. And I mean, it happens in stages. So, I mean, first you practice getting yourself out and getting your belt off and memorizing where the door handle is and where your hand positions are, or kicking out a window. And then, I mean, it leads up to you dumping this fuselage thing in the pool upside down and you have to get yourself out. And there's actually a smaller one too as well, that it's for more advanced, this little cage thing with doors and windows. And what they do in that one is they tumble you until you're just completely disoriented, and then you have to get your way out. And I was in the tumbler one and got out, but I just had no idea which way was the surface of the water, kind of thing. And
yeah,
I got like 1 foot on the ground, luckily, and just like got my head up and vomited.
Oh my God.
I took in water and I can see how people drown. I learned a lot in that moment.
Yeah.
So that was
like two things. One, I would never have expected for my first job in tech to have to experience that. And two, Glenn, I think this whole podcast episode, you've talked about a million things that like have terrified me. I've had a stress reaction here and you're just like so calm talking about it. But I very much want to know how you do that too.
I don't know. Maybe that's why I got the job I have. We just figure it out, start moving forward. Take things as they come.
Yeah. And I want to touch too on, okay, so you talked about you faced a challenge a couple of years ago and that was kind of part of this decision-making thing, right? And so I'm not positive about what that challenge was, but I think that maybe that has to do with your diabetes diagnosis. Is that true?
That's true. I mean, that's a whole other story in itself, if we have time for it. The brief version is I lost 38 pounds in about 3 months. And that was while I was like eating everything in sight. I would literally like go to the grocery store at 10 o'clock at night because I was hungry. And I mean, to anybody familiar with type 1 diabetes, this is really kind of stereotypical behavior. Other symptoms kind of went back a few years. It had been progressing. It runs in my family. My grandfather had it. My grandfather died of it. And so, you know, I drink 1.5 gallons of water per day. It would be like, you know, 1 liter bottle of Nalgene. I'd be like, I just need a little drink of water before bed. And I'd drink the whole thing in like 10 seconds. So made a doctor's appointment and, the doctor knew, and it's quite unusual to get, type 1 diabetes as an adult. Normally there's kind of two ages that are common to have an onset of type 1 diabetes. One is around 5 or 6 years old. The second one is late teens, you know, 18 to 20 years old can have an onset. And I was a bit older than that. And so they sent me to an endocrinologist. You get all these tests. And I mean, the interesting part about this whole story, they gave me needles. It's all no fun. And I had to learn how to use it. But is that I got introduced to this idea of an open source artificial pancreas. And this is a really amazing community, because the open source solutions have far surpassed what's available commercially. And this is, the term is called We're Not Waiting, if you're looking for it on the internet. And it's actually, I believe, driven by parents of diabetic kids who build software and have made an incredible set of open source tools for advanced diabetic care. And so there's kind of two main components to this. One is, it's called the continuous glucose monitor. And it's like a sticker that gets stuck on you with a Bluetooth transmitter on it. And there's a little filament of wire that goes under your skin. And it continuously monitors your blood sugar levels throughout the day. And you get that from a company called Dexcom. That's where I get mine. There's a few. And then you have an insulin pump. And it continuously microdoses insulin throughout the day to maintain your proper blood sugar level. And the crazy part about the situation is that these are made by two different companies, and they've never actually got together and figured out, you know, hey, I can sense the blood sugar level, and you can dose the insulin. When I eat, if I'm just using a straight up insulin pump, I have to, you know, count my carbs and program how much insulin to give myself. Or if I'm going to exercise, I have to like reduce my insulin level ahead of time, or else I'll need to eat sugar because exercise burns sugar. So what this open source community did is they built a bridge between the two with university researchers as well. And so my phone, the software running on my Android phone, acts as a kind of an artificial intelligence bridge. There's a certain algorithm of analysis in there that senses my blood sugar levels and automatically adjusts my insulin dosage levels. And like I said, the crazy thing is that this couldn't have been figured out by industry. They couldn't have talked to each other and done this. I mean, people were literally taking the wireless remote for the insulin pump and reverse engineering the commands to it.
I mean, so this is all fascinating. And one of the things that I was thinking about, so my first instinct, if I weren't in tech, would be to be really afraid of that. But I was wondering if because you kind of understand what's going on, did that impact like the solutions that you were looking for, or your trust in this, or I don't know, just how did you decide to make this?
I mean, it's all not the FDA approved. Let's come up with that right away. I think that I couldn't have pursued this if I didn't have a background in tech. I mean, I had to build Android clients from scratch and deploy them myself and that sort of thing. Number one. Number two, I was lucky I even found it. It isn't like this is advertised. It's not like the doctors are telling you about it. I mean, my family doctor, I don't even think I've explained it to her. She's just like, yeah, you got a pump? Good. My endocrinologist knows about it because he specializes in this, and he thought, you know, this is pretty cool. Let me know how it goes. You got a background. You know what you're doing. And he said he has one other patient, you know, of his entire patient load, he has one other patient who does looping. That's what it's called. You close the loop. And he was like, yeah, tell me about it when you come back next time. And so in terms of me being afraid to try it, not really. Oh, yeah, I was at first, but everything's subtle in degrees, right? It's not like live or die, pass or fail. There's a lot of areas of gray in between everything. And I mean, I had problems at first, I'll say that. The nurse that set me up with my pump initially, who probably still doesn't know that I have this running, initially dosed me about 30% too high, maybe more than that, maybe 50% too high even, on my insulin. And it's really subtle from me, who doesn't know anything, to tell that necessarily, because there's, and that's my kind of constant level throughout the day. She dosed really high, and it's mixed in. I'm giving myself other doses when I eat. So it's really hard for me to tell that that base level was too high. And so I had problems with my algorithm setup based on that for 6 months, maybe. Hmm. And I say problems, what's the solution to the problem? It just means I got to eat. And so, luckily I have a constant monitor and it has an alarm that tells me when I need to eat. But I got, there's a book that the endocrinologist recommended I read initially, and that was like months before. And so I started reading this book one day and it started giving me these protocols to actually determine my correct levels. And I did them, and it involves a lot of fasting and pricking your finger every 2 hours, even throughout the night. And that's how I got my correct base level figured out. And once I got that, things started to go smoother with the artificial pancreas feedback loop.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's tough too when the kind of thing takes time to figure out, and it's also like your health, you know, like your body. And it's just so hard. I don't know.
I never really found someone to talk to about this. I'm still going at it by myself, and it's one reason why I bring it up sometimes. It's like if there's someone else struggling with this, I want them to talk to me. The docs, let's just say open source docs, is enough said there. But they tell you, and there's like a gajillion settings on this thing, and they tell you kind of what, give you an explanation of each setting, but they don't really tell you how to know what to set it to, like how it applies to you. And so there's been a lot of trial and error there on my own part. I mean, it goes on every week, every day, trying different things, trying different settings. And I don't have everything dialed in yet, but it's like way closer than it was. So, I mean, I still consider myself lucky to have stumbled on this, number one. Number two, lucky to have the technical knowledge to even get it running by myself. And number three, like the effectiveness of the treatment using the open source system is light years ahead of what is available through traditional medicine. Like there is absolutely no comparison, not even in the same ballpark.
So hard to like imagine. Yeah.
Right. And that's what's so frustrating. I don't know. The healthcare industry is one of the things that frustrates me the most for like exactly this reason, right? Like there are things that they try that we treat people over and over in the very same ways that are not accurate or not the best ways. And then newer and better ways aren't pursued, or they just take so much time, or just doctors don't even know to offer them. Right. And so then there's just, I don't know, my inner rage comes out when I talk about this because it's not fair. Like we're letting people down by not pursuing these different ways or the most exciting way or whatever. Like maybe you're not going to make headlines for doing this thing. And so then nobody pursues it. But,
oh gosh, you know, put like, insurance companies in that mix?
It's the worst. I'm in the middle of that right now. And it's just such a shame. And that's why, you know, I'm really glad that you talked about this because, you know, hopefully one person hears it and they tell another person. And just, I think even sometimes knowing that there are options out there that you haven't stumbled upon is enough to provide hope for somebody who's just like going through a really rough time with it, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it's quite humorous looking back. There's even if you have a child who's diabetic, there's great monitoring tools that have been built in. So, I mean, I monitor myself, obviously I'm able to do that. But I mean, this is all internet enabled through cellular data. If you have this on your child, you can be monitoring constantly. If they're not managing themselves, you can manage them remotely. Mm-hmm. If it's a small child, we set up this up, initially for me, it seemed like a good idea because I do a lot of work outside by myself. And this is, I mean, in that initial month when I was first trying this, and I had monitoring set up to my wife's phone, and the exact same monitoring you'd use if you had one of your children on this. And I was working at the back of the property doing my thing and not really paying attention to anything. And she like comes running through the field with, I don't remember, like sugar and water and all these things. And I'm just like, hey, what's going on? And she's like convinced I'm like laying there dying because my connection was disconnected.
Oh no.
It was not reading accurately.
Well, it's nice to know she is ready to run.
That was the last day the monitoring was installed on her phone. After that, she's like, you're on your own. So now I'm on my own. But it's been good. It's very difficult to get into that type of situation now that I have it tuned better.
Yeah. Wow. Glenn, this has just been such a great hour plus talking through all of these things. I just very much like hearing you talk about all of these things that you've gone through and all of these things that you've done, and just hearing your story, because you're a really great storyteller. So it's easy to, you know, just sit back and listen. So I very much appreciate you sharing all of this stuff for everybody else to hear as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like you have a unique perspective on life. I'm sure some of that is from, you know, created from your experiences, and some of that is, you know, I don't know, innate or whatever, but I always like kind of listen to you talk about your experiences and, you know, the way you've kind of viewed things as you go through them. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
All right. Well, that's our episode for today. We will put some of those links in the show notes. And again, thanks so much for being here with us, Glenn, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Virtual Coffee Podcast. This episode was produced by Dan Ott and Becca Harrott-Weigel and edited by Dan Ott. If you have questions or comments, you can hit us up on Twitter at virtualcoffee.io, or you can email us at podcast@virtualcoffee.io. You can find the show notes, plus you can sign up for our newsletter to find out what Virtual Coffee's been up to on our website at virtualcoffee.io.
Please subscribe to our podcast and be sure to leave us a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.